I want to welcome everyone to today's interview with Gabrielle Kaufman. I'm very, very excited to have this conversation with Gabrielle. And I'm going to introduce Gabrielle a little, perhaps with a little lengthy kind of introduction, but her background is, I think, so extensive and so interesting and so incredibly relevant to what we're talking about that I can't help myself. So here goes. Gabrielle Kaufman is a dance movement therapist, and she's a licensed professional clinical counselor with over 20 years' experience, and she currently is director of training and technical assistance for the L.A. County Perinatal Mental Health Task Force. Prior to this position, she served as director of the New Moms Connect program of Jewish Family Services of Los Angeles, which provides a range of services to new parents, especially those suffering from symptoms of postpartum depression. Ms. Kaufman has worked extensively with new families. She's aided in providing solutions to many, many parenting concerns. She's run a bunch of programs for high-risk children and teens. She's taught classes for parents of newborns and toddlers. And she runs support groups for single parents and women with postpartum depression. She's spoken widely, published articles on parenting, and she's served as editor for Bringing Light to Motherhood. She now serves as Los Angeles coordinator for Postpartum Support International, and she also has a private practice in LA providing services in both English and Spanish. So after hearing that, I hope, listeners, you understand why I just felt compelled to really give you that incredible and, you know, really that detailed introduction, Gabrielle, because I'm just thrilled to have you here and just so grateful for you taking the time to have this conversation with me today.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
Yay. So we're just going to jump right in. And here's my first question. When we prepare for parenthood for the first time, right, first-time parents, I'm just wondering, are there any emotional speed bumps, so to speak, that you think we should be especially aware of?
Absolutely. So when I do my trainings, we really look at, you know, what are risk factors for really having a difficult adjustment to parenting. And the risk factors very often involve not only our personal history, but our family's personal history. And when, you know, so there's kind of this terminology, and I'm going to try not to be too term heavy, but there's a terminology we talk about, intergenerational transmission of trauma. And what does that mean? And that means basically that challenges, history kind of is carried with us from generation to generation, and so for good and for challenge. So I think it's an important thing for us to look at, not only, you know, what you, I know our kids sometimes have, you know, ethnic day and bring your favorite food from the country of origin, but
right,
I think it's important for us to look a little bit deeper and look at what are the stories not only of our childhood but our parents' childhood and as far back as possible. Because on some level, it is through that we can expect those emotions in some ways to surface when we become a parent. A colleague of mine uses this expression that I really love, which is becoming a parent is one of those, the only time in your life where you go in as one person and you come out as two. But I'm almost going to kind of give it a different flavor, which is we go in as identifying ourselves as kind of one person, having a clear sense of who we are, or at least as clear as we can. But then we come out with two live beings, and yet there are so many other beings that kind of come alive in that experience of giving birth and in that kind of birth of us as a parent. So I think I'm talking pretty broadly, but I what I'm trying to say is it's nuanced, it's dimensional, it's very multi-flavored. And so when we look at our journey into parenting, it's kind of important to look at it, both look forward, look back, look to the sides, and kind of look all around us, because I think there's information, and I think that's the way we can, you know, use the word speed bump. That's the way we can drive safely to this parenting journey.
Well, I love this image that you just described of, you know, like this almost, you know, a clan of live beings is what sort of the image that I had emerging through the birth experience, as opposed to, as you said, the sort of common assumption that it is, you know, we go in one person and come out two live beings, that it's actually more of like a larger system, a larger group that includes the past, key players of our past, key players in our presence. And I know in thinking about the past, and you talk about personal history and the stories of our childhood and our parents' childhoods, that, I know in our conversation before this interview, we talked about the sort of notion of the ghosts from the past or the ghosts that can haunt our parenting. And I'm wondering, what else can you tell us about those, quote, ghosts, and understanding that it's not like ghosts, scary, 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 but that, sometimes ghosts are like, as you said, the sort of positive legacy that gets carried on, but also sometimes the challenges.
So I'm going to share with you a story. I did a training last week, and this woman, as we were kind of reviewing, so my trainings focus mostly working with clinicians on screening and treatment and kind of preparation for motherhood. And this one woman, as I talked about this issue, looked at me and kind of went white. And then she said, I have to share a story. So I looked at this woman and I said, please, let's share this story. So her story said that when she gave birth to her son, she was perfectly fine. She was in a relationship that was supportive. And as soon as he was born, she fell into this heavy place where she was sobbing and sobbing for days. For 3 days, she couldn't stop crying, and nobody knew what to do about it. And she all of a sudden realized, something happened to me. So she called up her mother, and she said, Mom, I need you to tell me what happened around the time of my birth. And her mom said, it happened a long time ago. You don't need to know. And so then she called her aunt, who had been with her at her bedside when she was born, and she said, you have to tell me. I have to know. So her aunt said to her, when you were born, your mother was running. She was running away. Your father was in prison, and your mother ran away to be with her family to get the support. She was so depressed and so scared and isolated. And then you were born premature and had to go into the hospital. And when she heard this information, she had never been told it. All of a sudden, her heaviness lifted. And she sobbed, for hearing that part of her journey, but her ability to own her own story allowed her to step into motherhood. So I think, there's kind of an old world belief that if we don't talk about things, we don't give it kind of the space and it'll just go away. But I think we look at things a little bit different now, and we look that once we can kind of own our story, it kind of goes into our cells, and we can kind of evolve with that knowledge and make choices consciously about them rather than holding them. And so the idea, in some ways, we could say she was a newborn. What did she remember? What did she know? But I think it was on this cellular level that she remembered this trauma. And since it hadn't been validated or shared, she just had to hold it there. Once she could share it, she was able to settle into motherhood and kind of recognize that this trauma had not only impacted her but shaped this new part, but it didn't have to be her only story. So I just found it a very powerful story.
Incredibly powerful. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah.
It also made me think about, two things. So I guess I've got two questions emerging from that. One is, what are the kinds of stories that you think are important for us to own that we do remember? But what are the kinds of things that people don't talk about? So that's my first question. And the second one is, what if we don't remember but we sense something? Sort of how do we work through that? So two very different questions, but if you could start with the first, like what are the range of things that we do have memories of or knowledge of that we might know about, but as you say, don't talk about, feel shame around, don't, quote, own, to use the word that you talked about.
Yeah. So there are two questions. Let me first start kind of with this idea of not sharing stories. I think for the right intentions, we kind of get caught up in this idea that if we give too much time to something sad or challenging, it will swallow it up. I don't know, Rona, if you've ever heard somebody say to you, if I start crying, I'll be washed away in a flood. The tears
course,
will never
or I'll
stop.
Never stop.
Yeah. So I think that's a bit of the mythology. Contrary to that, my experience has actually been the opposite. if we don't let those tears out, they kind of freeze us in time and make it difficult for our functioning. And usually what happens is a release of those tears. There's a theory, if we look at the idea of the importance of looking at trauma, that if a dog bites you and that bite is holding on to you, that if you pull against the bite, it will rip you. But if you push into the dog's mouth, the dog's teeth will open, the jaw will open, you'll be free. So if I look at that as kind of hard memories or trauma or scary things, if we go in, it doesn't become as scary anymore and that jaw will release. As you can tell, I like images.
So, I love it. It's beautiful. They're great metaphors. It's fabulous.
Yeah, so sometimes we kind of go into the, as you say, go into the belly of the beast. But once you go in, it makes sense and it loosens up and it frees us. But there's so much old, I think it's fear. I think it's kind of the idea that it's scary to look at scary things. I think another reason we don't talk about scary things is, it sounds crazy, but I think there's a fear of contagion. We don't want to be contagious, you know, exposed to something that might be contagious and make us feel horrible. So we have to kind of be cognizant of where those fears come from. And I don't know if you've heard stories of people who came back from World War II, soldiers who saw horrible things, and the message was, don't talk about it, don't deal with it, because it was too horrifying, and it's time to come back and live your life. You got your life back. Everything's normal. You're happy. You're alive. And what happened with those memories isn't that they vanish. It's that they kind of manifest in different ways. And my theory, my belief, and it's not my own, but is really the idea that not only do we carry it through our lives, but it becomes that ghost in the next generation. So the story I never got to tell is transmitted to you, but not in a clear sense, but in a mystery, in a feeling, in an anxiety that we carry. And then it keeps being passed on from generation to generation until the story is told. So I think your second question is, you know, what story should be told? Or I clarify again, because I think I got lost in the first question.
Well, no, I love it. Please, let's get lost some more, because this is fabulous. One of the questions was, so what are the kinds of things, you know, if we were to name some of, give some labels to folks who are listening, it's like, well, what is it that I might not be dealing with? So something that comes to mind, you know, there, I think some of the big stuff is, you know, as a child, you know, sexual abuse, being sexually abused as a child, or physically abused, or you know, emotionally abused as a child, and not talking about it and holding that back. But I'm wondering, like, what are the kinds of other things that might, you know, we might remember but don't really think are worth talking about or important enough?
So I'm going to share another story, which I think is interesting. So I was at a conference this weekend, and on my way back, I was sitting next to a man on an airplane who had gone to his grandmother's funeral. And when he was back in his hometown, he took pictures, and he was very excited to share pictures with me. And he was pointing, like, this right here, this pond is the pond that we would find tadpoles. And you see this house right here, that tree in front of that house, that's where I fell out and I got my first broken arm. And as he was telling it, it was almost that he was really owning his story. And there was nothing about it that we would say, you know, gee, that was like World War II. It wasn't deeply traumatizing. It was just he felt there was something about going back home that he could own his story. So mm-hmm. I actually really believe there is nothing too little to be shared. Mm-hmm. You know, even kind of to look at, you know, look at that tree. That tree was a tree we used to climb in. Look at that school. That's the school I used to go to. And in that school, I had this really sweet friend. Gee, I wonder what happened. I think I'm really very fond of the idea of sharing stories. Mm-hmm. And I even like the idea of helping in parenting with sharing stories with their children. So, a role model of mine, Ruth Beaglehole, who runs the Echo Parenting Center here in Los Angeles, really puts forward the idea of writing stories with your children about anything. And so, for example, you lost your temper with your child. You sit down and you take a pencil and you draw stick figures and you say, I came home and I shouted at you and how did you feel? And the journey of sharing that story together helps the parent and the child kind of share the emotional experience, validate that it was real, and then kind of in some ways at the end of it, they can close the book and put it on the shelf. So it's part of their history, but it doesn't have to be the only part of their history.
Love it.
So there's nothing too small. There's nothing too small.
Love it. Beautiful.
To share.
So my other question, thank you so much. That was a great way of answering. Didn't even have the memory and had to hunt it down.
Uh-huh.
Let's say a variation on that story, don't have a memory, maybe have no way to get the actual memory,
mm-hmm.
but just have a sense, have a feeling, have anxiety, or things start coming off that aren't logical to us, don't make sense, but we just know there's something there, but maybe we don't actually find out, quote, the truth of what happened. How can those of us who might deal with some of that more energetic feeling?
Wonderful. So there's a whole movement on this mindfulness really means. It just means being present and being in the moment. And at least my interpretation, somebody will come and criticize me later for that. But I really do believe it's just this idea of being present in the moment. And trust, and I really do talk about kind of trusting your gut, trusting your kishkes, right? Like listening in. There's something in there. A colleague at the conference this weekend actually said something I found interesting, which is, our memories, our stories, our past, they're actually pretty subjective. What I think happened to my ancestors, I'll never know. They're not alive anymore. But I'm feeling something, and it means something to me. So that I think to validate whatever meaning comes up for you. So I would actually invite someone, if they're feeling unsettled, to find, a safe space, find somebody to watch the baby for 20 minutes, and just allow yourself to be in that moment and just catch your breath and just breathe, not any particular way, just breathe and validate that something came up. And I actually, I'm very engaged in the idea of using a creative process. So as you're doing it, it might be an image that comes up or might be words that come up, and just write them down. Share them. If you don't have words, just draw a picture. Something that takes it kind of from the internal experience, but it validates it by bringing it out. So really to find that space, to allow some breath, to be present, and the strongest thing that I would recommend too is to remove that judgmental eye, because I think we are so judgmental. And to just say, I'm feeling this, it's valid because it's there. It doesn't need to be externally validated. And I think we get caught up in that too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So to validate, to be validating for yourself. And something I'll tell moms who say that, but other people don't think it or they don't make sense of it, I say if your child says something and they have a feeling, validating that feeling is important. I kind of think if we're going to do that for our children, allowing us to model it and do it for ourselves, really important.
Absolutely.
That said, I do, for full disclosure, I judge myself way too often as well. I think it's a journey to get to that place.
Well, it's interesting. I was working with a new client yesterday, and we were talking about the notion of the inner critic, which is, we talked about my coaching. We call it the saboteur and coactive coaching that I was trained in. And, I was explaining the concept to her, and she was saying, Oh, it's terrible. I'm filled with it. But she sort of said it like this is shocking, and that she was admitting this to me. I was like, yeah, welcome to the human race. We are so in this together. Yes, we sort of those cliches, right? We're our worst critics and all of that. So absolutely, absolutely.
And I think it's all a continuum. I think we're all on a journey. There's no, I've never met somebody who has no, who's no harsh critic of themselves at some point. Even the image of saying, I was kind of talking about that exercise of closing the door and having a moment of quiet, maybe even imagining just for this very short period of time, not only on the other side of the door is the chaos in my life, but maybe I'm going to put judgment outside. And if I ever need it, I'll open it, it'll flood back in. I promise it'll come back. But to kind of invite yourself to push judgment away for a moment.
Great idea.
And So to kind of to engage in, and that is part of that mindfulness too. Just to be clear, I will try to do this. And I guess all of it is, like I said, in that continuum, it's all attempting. There's no perfection in this journey, which I guess to talk about parenting, I find that's also one of the bigger struggles I've seen is that, you know, we get into this place where we think that we have to do it right. I had a colleague tell me that she was really used to doing things in her life where she felt very good. And she could produce it, and it was done, and people liked it. And parenting isn't like that. You know, there's no final product that comes right away that people are going to give you an A-plus for.
Absolutely.
But if we set up that paradigm for ourselves, what we're constantly doing is getting bad grades, and then that kind of feeds back into our feeling about our own capacity to parent.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a good metaphor in terms of that sort of like grading system and how grading system, and I just like also this notion of like creating a product it's done.
Yeah.
Parenting is never done.
No, it's never done.
It's never done. So that kind of goal-oriented mentality, I just need to get this done, finish it, and make it this perfect, pristine thing, which, you know, of course, perfectionism is a whole other conversation for us to have. But you're right that it's the wrong paradigm. It's an inaccurate paradigm to apply to parenting. And yet so many of us apply exactly that kind of concept to it. I want to go back. One of the things that I was thinking about, you know, we've been talking about this in the context of new parents and, you know, new baby and whatever. It strikes me, though, in listening to you, that this sort of grappling with, you know, what we might call the ghosts or the lives that preceded us, including our own life as a child, as well as our parents' lives, our, you know, ancestors' lives, that past can and does impact our parenting, and I'd say our relationships throughout our lives. That it's, you know, that maybe there's something about becoming a parent for the first time that might be a particularly intense moment in which that takes place. But I'm wondering if you might want to, you know, if you could speak to how this isn't just, again, that sort of like one moment in time that this is something for us to look at, but perhaps something that's a process.
Okay, so here's where I went right away. So, Rona, I'm going to kind of ask you to jump into an exercise with me. Would you mind?
Go for it.
Okay. I want you to think for a moment about what it was like for you to be 15 years old. And maybe think about the social experiences of it, the academic experiences of it, what was it like to be in your body? What was it like to look in the mirror? How did you think about your impulses? How did you think about your parents? How did you think about your family? How did you think about the way you dressed? So just take 1 minute to kind of bring that 15-year-old consciousness up for yourself.
Okay, I'm just going to let you know. I'm just going to say out loud. I've got anxiety running through my body. Like I'm like,
for
it's
sure.
Like okay, I've got to breathe because a lot of the questions you asked were very powerful in terms of very negative associations for me.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to breathe.
I just want to point out that you went there in a millisecond.
Yep.
Just a millisecond. Our access to that teenager in us is pretty powerful. And, you know, as you and I both know, teenagers, that kind of the adolescence is this really challenging time. Your whole, everything about you is changing. Everything, the world is changing. Your brain is changing, and yet your body is changing faster. So imagine, as quickly as you went to that place, and by the way, thank you for going there.
Absolutely.
You don't need to share anything more personal, but just kind of recognize what came up. Imagine what happens when your child, let's even say daughter because you're a woman, is 15.
Mm-hmm.
So that ghost of your 15-year-old is all of a sudden in your face.
Right.
And your daughter or son may not look like you. In fact, most likely their experience is quite different than yours, but it doesn't matter. Because all of a sudden, that 15-year-old is in your face again. So I guess what I want to say is, and I will share with you personally, I have a 15-year-old daughter. So it's
I was waiting to hear if you were going to say something. But yes, yes, thank you for sharing that.
In my case, every bleeping day. But there is that 15-year-old there physically, but she's not me. But unfortunately, if we are not in touch with that 15-year-old from our past, that 15-year-old ghost, it's going to impact their parenting.
Yeah.
And we could go to any other stage, but I do just know adolescence is such such a keyed-up time in all of our lives, and I imagine anyone else who might be listening to this has at least something from their teenage years that brought a little bit of a lump in their throat.
Yeah.
Go ahead. So I just want to say, whenever your child is going through something that you went through in your life, it's really important to just allow yourself the time to recognize that there's a memory for you, but then in that mindful way, recognize that that is your memory that doesn't necessarily interpret your child's experience.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things I'm thinking about, you know, that's so important about what you're saying, also thinking about my own childhood and also family legacy. As you know, my father was a Holocaust survivor. I mean, in my family, there are multiple generations of very clear trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a fairly traumatic childhood myself, and I am aware, so I'm thinking in sort of split ways listening and talking to you about this. One is, as much as we can own our stories in a conscious, intentional way, the better it is certainly for our own well-being and also for all our relationships, including and perhaps especially our relationships with our kids. And I also want to say that those of us who, haven't had the chance to, sometimes don't even know what stories there are, haven't until perhaps listening to this had a sense of the importance of doing that. But I can say I think I know a lot of my stories and quite a few of my family legacy stories, and yet I get triggered with great regularity with my children. regularity with my children. So what I just also want to say and add to the conversation we're having is I'm grateful. I think most of the time I am very aware of when I'm triggered and hopefully pull myself out of it quickly. And also the power, as you were talking about in terms of that Ruth Beaglehole exercise, the power of repair, right? What the Gottman, Dr. John Gottman calls, the power of repair when there's conflict, when there's, potential damage or negativity in a relationship, this isn't only about trying to own our stories so we don't pass them along to our children or our children don't sense and struggle with what's ours and our ancestors, but also that when it comes up, because I think for pretty much everyone or the vast majority of us, at some point we'll get triggered as parents, that we then also find ways to repair that with our children, whether it's that beautiful example that you gave in terms of eco-parenting around, drawing the story out of it or telling the story or just what I do most frequently, which is just say, you know what, I'm so sorry. I got really angry and was impatient, and that had nothing to do with you. I was getting upset, and I put that on you, and I'm so incredibly sorry. And I've got to say, it amazes me just how quickly my children respond positively to that and how quickly they seem able to let go.
For
sure. I just wanted to say that.
No, and repair, I mean, I'm all about the idea of repair. I remember once having a difficult time with my child and going in and saying, wait a minute, can we have a do-over here?
Mm-hmm.
In regards also to your comment about triggers, we're always going to get triggered. Triggers are not going to go away. It's not that we're going to stop getting triggered. It's that we are going to you know, either develop some tools to cope, not either, as well, develop tools to cope with them and maybe understand a little bit about the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've found so often over the years when people say, my parents were terrible, I'm going to do the opposite of them, they fall into the same trap going through the back door, thinking,
yep,
I'm not going to fall into that trap, and they fall into that same trap. So it's not enough to say I'm going to do the opposite. It's much more important to recognize that we are going to fall into trap, but what are we going to do when we get in there? How are we going to handle it? How are we going to move forward?
So,
and the other thing I wanted to say, too, is just because you know it doesn't mean that you're processing it and your struggles with it are over. And sharing another story with a client this week said to me, this woman, her mother abandoned her, left her with her father. She actually has this very, very keen memory of being a three-year-old and her mother walking out and never coming back. And when she started to work with me in her late 20s, she said to me, I'm happy to work with you in therapy, but I will let you know I'm done working on my mom. And, you know, here we are several years later, and she's on the cusp of being a mother herself, and it's coming up again. And I said to her, you know, we don't, big things like that, we don't work on, and it's over. You can't, you know, your mother disappearing out of your life is a trauma that you don't easily work through and get over. It's just you manage, you cope better until a different trigger comes up that you need a new skill to get through.
That's a great way of describing it. So I'm wondering, how do these kinds of ghosts or past lives, whether our own or, and I don't mean spiritually past lives, that's probably a whole other conversation about the effect of past lives, but how does a sort of like the ghosts from the past and, you know, ghosts of parenting past, you know, what are some of the ways in which what we're talking about impact our relationships with our partners, with our families, and with our children? I mean, I think we've talked a little bit about the children stuff, and I'm wondering, you know, what else?
For sure.
What else?
Well, you know, I mean, we with our partners, we come from different homes and different backgrounds and different beliefs and different traditions. Even if we both grow up in the same neighborhood with the same religion, there's every family has its own different culture. And parents, you were parented differently than your partner. So for sure it's going to come up because, you know, let's be honest, it's not only one partner that gets triggered, everybody gets triggered. And I think part of it is really having those conversations in the same way that I was talking about kind of making books with your children. I think it's kind of cool if you want to make a book with your partner or at least make kind of a verbal book. Let's an oral book. You know, let's talk about our stories. Let's introduce ourselves and our stories and our memories and share it. Recognizing that our impulses may be different, and trying to figure out what makes those impulses different. So, you know, how do you manage that? How do you talk through those things? How do you work on them? In terms of valuing your partner and valuing that your partner has a different journey.
Right.
Also, I don't know, an image came up when you said something about those ghosts from our childhood, and I just got back from a dance therapy conference, so I'm going to say there's something meaningful to dancing with those ghosts, to allowing their presence in your life. How do we dance with them? And I say dance almost more metaphorically, but that idea that having ancestry, having those ghosts around can be supportive and loving, and how can we almost invite the image of them in, you know, when we miss them, those of us who have lost a parent, how can we invite that idea, that image, the good warmth of that parent to be with you at a difficult moment. I don't know, I think a little bit about how when you're a child and you're sick and you really want your mommy, well, guess what? You know, when you're an adult and you're sick, you kind of want your mommy too, and maybe your mommy's not around.
Mm-hmm.
So is there a way to invite that mommy in? And maybe sharing that with your partner, with your spouse, to say, you know, I'm needing nurturing right now. I'm missing that parent. I'm missing, I'm needing something from you. And I guess I look at when we can ask for help, particularly from our partner, we develop that skill of getting that need met, but we're also modeling for our child to be able to ask for help and to get their needs met.
Right, right.
So I feel like I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
But you know what? I think you are. You know, one of the other things that occurred to me while you were talking about this was that part of what that can also offer is for those of us who perhaps didn't have, you know, have lost parents but didn't have that nurturing parent.
Yeah.
Because I know, for example, when my father died, and I think I've shared with you in the past, my father was, in today's terminology, had bipolar 1, then it was known as manic depression, and was quite extremely ill for very large chunks of his life and therefore my life. And when he died, the largest part of my grief, it's shifted over time in a more positive direction, but the largest part of my grief was the loss of the father I wanted to have.
Absolutely.
The sane, calm, present, consistently loving, not scary. You know, that was my greatest grief.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what I was thinking when you were talking about is also like that sort of being able to speak to a partner, I'm needing nurturing now, I'm needing, you know, so that sometimes it's not I'm missing that parent, mm-hmm. but it's that I'm missing the parent I never had. I'm missing being parented in a kind, supportive, loving, accepted way. So
yeah.
I just want to throw that out there too as another dimension to what you're talking about.
And it's so true. I'm really glad you brought it in because it's there. And to some degree, even the most well-intentioned parents sometimes fail. But your dad had his own ghosts, his own
absolutely
monsters that made it that he wasn't available for you. And unfortunately, you know, that left a hole. The gift is that you recognize the whole is there. For many people, they don't recognize that absence is there, and they kind of walk through, stumble through life, you know, not knowing what they don't know.
Right. Right. You know, so in what you're talking about, it's funny. I had originally wanted to ask you, how can I prevent this impacting my own kids? And now I want to change the question to sort of how, you know, in addition to some of the examples you've already given, how else might, you know, parents be able to decrease the negative impact? And how will I know that I'm navigating it, you know, capably or as capably as possible?
Okay, so I'm a huge fan of books. I really think developing an emotional vocabulary with your children early on is really great. There's a book that I recommend for, like, toddlers, which is Dr. Seuss's My Many Colored Days.
Hmm.
It was written by him, but it was illustrated posthumously, so it's not his illustrations. But it's just, it's very colorful and pretty and just names feelings. So that's one for younger kids. But I think developing an emotional vocabulary early on with your children helps to build resilience. Because when a child can begin to articulate their feelings, it helps you to know that you can respond to it. So it kind of goes back to what I said, which is earlier, I'm not sure we're going to be able to avoid triggers. So
yep.
It's not a matter of saying, let's go through life and nothing's going to, you know, you're going to have this steel shield protecting you. I don't necessarily think that's going to be realistic. But to say when things get triggered, how do you manage them? I think sometimes we over-talk our children. So I'm also very much about kind of that physical connection. There's a lot of research about gentle, loving touch. And obviously when you do touch with even your own child, you should always ask permission first. But when your child is having a difficult time, chest to chest, which is what they recommend right after the birth of a baby, you know, you put your baby right on your chest, there is something that happens. I can't describe the science of it, but it's very powerful. So when you give your child a genuine, loving, kind of accepting hugs, and you hug and you don't have even words, you're transmitting to your child that you accept them, that you love them, and that you recognize they're having a difficult moment. And whereas you're not going to take it away, you can be in that space with them.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Beautiful.
So I'm all about the hug, but I also want to say, when it comes to touch of any kind, and even with a baby, when I see a baby and somebody says, "Would you like to hold my baby?" I look at the baby and I say to the baby directly, "Is it okay if I hold you?" Touch is very powerful and wonderful and loving, and at the same time, touch is intrusive. So you have to make sure that whomever you touch is a partner in that.
Mm-hmm. And how do you know the baby says yes? That's where I went. So I'm laughing, but I mean that as a genuine question.
Well, truthfully, it's about being present. Is that baby, deeply uncomfortable in your arms? Sometimes that baby is fussy. And if you can hold the baby and soothe the baby in your arms eventually, then you know that the baby is comfortable. And if the baby continues to be very agitated and fussy, there might be something you want to find out. It might not be about you, but I think it's important to recognize that. No, the baby's not going to say, "Sure, pick me up." But there is, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but I've seen a parent, for the best of intentions, the baby is crying and they get very close to the baby's face and then they try and make happy faces and try and get the baby to kind of get silly and funny, but that baby is crying and possibly like overtired. And so what they need isn't the stimulus. They need, they don't need the stimulation. They really just need to be held and soothed. So, but part of that too, parenting is not something that comes to us intuitively. It's not innate. It's not what we were told originally. We kind of have to learn how to do it. And part of our learning is learning from the baby who's our partner in this learning journey. They're learning us, we're learning them.
Absolutely. And I think that's also a really good example, because I think one of the things that often happens, I was going to say with new parents, but I think with parents, period, is that sort of, how do we intervene in that, projecting our own stuff onto, the crying baby? And I don't mean just like, this is me crying out and I'm projecting it onto you crying out my stuff. I mean, oh no, I'm doing something wrong. That's why you're crying. I have to stop this. I think sometimes the getting in a baby's face is a parent's anxiety and discomfort with their child being in discomfort and crying out. And sort of, again, that kind of self-managing our own anxiety, our own issues, so that we can separate, I need to, quote, fix this, from how do I acknowledge what's going on with you? How do I, maybe you're hungry, maybe you're tired, but sort of to try and, from that calmer parenting place, try to figure out how you can best support the baby without that kind of energy of in-your-faceness.
For sure. Well, I'll be honest. Colicky babies, let's just stay with the baby thing, but even a very emotional child who has difficulty with that self-regulation at an older age, but that colicky baby experience brings up, or can bring up for a parent, that sense of a failure. Like, I cannot soothe my baby. And so then what happens is that we call it the double whammy. So not only is your baby agitated and you can't soothe your baby, but then you start to feel like a failure, and that causes agitation in you, and then the baby senses that, and it builds and builds. And as I say, what colic means to doctors? It means we have no idea what's going on.
Yes, I think we're not even using, a lot of people aren't even using the word. Now they say fussy, the baby's being fussy
baby.
Because I think now, because it's recognized that colic really isn't a thing, right? It's not a condition. Yeah.
And there's actually a group called the Fussy Baby Network, and they will do home visits. And I remember going to the lecture and saying, God, what are they going to tell me? How are they going to tell me how to fix the fussy baby? And really what they provide is just holding space. The visitor will be there with you and validate, this is really hard. And you're not a failure, this is hard. And once you get that validation and that holding space, something in you can settle. And in the same way, when it comes to when we're so you were talking about I'm talking about attachment theory a little bit when you're talking about repair. Another thing is that misattunement.
Yeah.
And I think we need to look not at we need to have this attuned, attached relationship with our child 24/7, because that's not a realistic thing. It's not going to work. It's when we are misattuned or when we have kind of a disruption in attachment, are we able to engage in a repair process? And I know I'm talking, you know, psychobabble a little bit, so I'll step back and explain what I mean. What I mean is, you know, with even the most healthy relationships in our lives, we're going to be misinterpreted. We're going to feel hurt. We're going to feel rejected. From an infant to, you know, a 99-year-old person, they're going to have moments when they, when their connections with people misfire. So I think we don't need to say, you know, to focus necessarily on the failures of attachment or attunement, but to really more look at what happens next. And when those misattunements happen, I think kind of that's when I really invite people to drop down into their gut and stop and take a breath, even in the very moment. And what is it telling you? What do I need to do in this moment? How can I repair this connection, or at least acknowledge it needs repair? I mean, to like almost an AA approach, you got to acknowledge it as a problem first.
Yeah.
Reckon something doesn't feel right. And when we can say something doesn't feel right, which kind of goes back to your very early question, which is to feel like, you know, in this kind of new parenting experience, when it, something feels off, our bodies are wise. Our intuition is wise. And we spend a lot of time shutting it down and maybe mm-hmm. awaken it a little bit. And once we can awaken that, I think there's a lot we can learn from ourselves, and we're, the, our resources can really help us through those difficult times.
It's great, and it's great advice to sort of remind all of us to listen to our intuition. I'm wondering if you have a response to something that I've had a client ask me, and I'd just be curious what your response might be or has been if this has occurred in your practice, which is especially around parenting, that a client said, well, sometimes I really have problems differentiating, you know, is this feeling my gut feeling that something's wrong or something's going on with my child that I need to attend to, or is this my fear? Is
uh-huh.
this my own stuff
yeah.
that... I'm misinterpreting as intuition. So I'd love to hear how you would approach that question.
It's a beautiful question, and what it actually does tell me is that this person that you were working with actually had some insight.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, here's what I will say, sometimes you just don't know. But when you can ask that question, you can really invite that process. So when I told you to channel your inner 15-year-old, it's that same, like, then go back. Go to yourself. Ask yourself, what is it about kind of my own fear, my own story that I think might be triggered here? And if you can make sense of it, then that might guide you in the right direction. Or if it just feels like, you know, this is the decision that I want to make. There's so much about parenting that is not clear cut. We don't know what we're doing. Every decision we make, I kind of feel like you throw it out there and you hold your breath and you think, did it work?
Yeah.
And you know, you have to have that ability to stop and to say, okay, I really messed this one up. and now I want to do it differently next time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there is something in it. Here's the other thing I really like suggest everybody do is find a parent that you can really talk to, not someone
yes.
who's judgmental, but
yes.
you could call up and I mean, I have a friend who I call up and I say, can I share my bad parenting moment with you? And she's like, great, because I have one to share with you. And it's really great to know that somebody's not going to turn to you and say, how could you possibly do that? But so be careful who you choose, but gosh, if you find someone, it's like a lifesaver.
I totally agree. I have a friend, and also my wife and I do this with each other, although we get a little sarcastic, which is not always a good thing, but I think in this case it's funny because we always say, so I have another, you know, fine parenting moment or great parenting moment that I would like to share with you. That's how we introduce our, quote, bad parenting moments. I say, here was like, yep, did a really great job on this one. So, yeah. But same idea. I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's very, very, very important. I have another question, I think, related to what we're talking about. Sort of, I'm wondering if some of the listeners are thinking, you know, I'm kind of thinking this sounds important, but I don't really know how this is, how to even find this information. This doesn't seem so relevant for me, but it seems so relevant for my partner, right? Mm-hmm. Like that I think sometimes we sort of may not be able to look at this stuff for ourselves, but oh my goodness, my partner, he's got all this stuff going on. Or in my case, oh, she's got all this stuff going on. And I'm wondering sort of how might you advise someone to sort of navigate that, both in relation to communication with a partner, but also in terms of reflection on oneself?
Well, it's a great thing. It's very easy to point fingers, and we really like to point fingers. And it just feels a lot safer if we can say, you know, things would be so much better if you were different. But I also know that if we start any conversation with someone we want to partner with in that format, we've lost them entirely. So mm-hmm. I think if we want someone else to be self-reflective, by the way, including our children, we have to start there ourselves. We have to be self-reflective ourselves. So in that same way, if you think that your partner is struggling or that these things are real, gosh, you're really describing my partner, think, okay, that's great, it might be, but is there anything in that might relate to you? In which case, you might be able to start the conversation and say, I thought of you, and then I realized that I have something to learn from it too. Mm-hmm. Because if you can tell somebody that you love that you have something to learn and you think they might benefit too, you're much more likely to get a partnership in that journey.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great. You know, thank you for this wonderful conversation. Before we kind of sign off and say goodbye, I would love to ask, like, any additional words of wisdom that you want to share with our listeners around this?
I guess, first of all, I just want to stop and say how fun it has been to talk about this with you. I can say even for myself that all of this parenting journey is something that I have learned by getting in the mud. So I guess what I might say is don't be afraid to get a little dirty. Don't be afraid to play with some of these theories that we've talked about and not get them, you know, as you determine right, because the truth is there is no right. There's information in being present. There's information in being in the moment. And the best thing that we can do is fail at something and learn from that failure, because if we just continue to hit our head against the wall, I don't think we're moving forward. But to look at it, to evaluate, to say, okay, how did that go? And to think, how do I want to do it differently, is really the journey that we're on. We're not on a journey that's got a straight linear path. And even in the same way, when somebody comes and says to you, there is a right way to feed your baby, and there is a right way to discipline your child, there is a right way, there are some clearly wrong ways, but for the most part, there is no single right way, or wouldn't we all be doing it? So I think to be kind and to look at it as an art, not a science, but mm-hmm. not to be afraid to get dirty, I guess.
Right. Right. Beautiful. Beautiful. So, Gabrielle, thank you so much for taking the time to share your incredible wisdom and humor and fabulous stories and exercises and ideas. I mean, it's just been wonderful and a very rich conversation for me, and I've thoroughly enjoyed having this conversation with you as well. So thank you.
And thank you, for the honor of feeling wise for a moment.
Absolutely. Oh, well. Oh, there's that inner critic. Let's watch where you're going to feel wise for many moments.
Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
For me too. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.